Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking to Sonia Clark. Welcome to Zero Hour, Sonia. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I just want to read a little bit about some of the things that you've accomplished. Have had work exhibited in over 100 venues in the UK, Brazil, South Africa, Canada, Taiwan, Austria, Australia, France, Switzerland. How do you have time to do your work? and throughout the U.S. in museums such as the Newark Museum of Art, UCLA, Fowler Museum, the Beaux Art Museum, Bellevue Art Museum, Indianapolis Museum of Art, Smithsonian Institution.
Okay, now you're just embarrassing me.
Yes, well, okay. And we're running out of time here, but believe me, folks, this list goes on. She has earned degrees from Cranbrook Academy of Art, where she received her MFA, the Art Institute of Chicago, where she received a BFA, and the Amherst College, where she received her BA. She is the recipient of the Romnus Award. And if all this isn't enough, she is a current professor and chair of the Crafts and Materials Studies Department at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. Okay, well, thank you very much for taking time out of obviously a very, very busy life and a very busy career to come and talk to us. I was reading some of the things that you had written and some of the things that have been written about you. One of the things that I found so interesting was your take on hand-me-downs. You know, I started to read it, and you were talking about hand-me-downs and things that, you know, you get handed down as a kid, and heirlooms, and what they mean to you and what they mean to you in your work. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think what you were reading was an essay that I had written after I'd given a talk on the importance of the object in making. And I, for a long time, I was really thinking about the difference between an object that is an heirloom and an object that is a hand-me-down.
Right.
And the difference between an object that's an heirloom is that an heirloom is something that has an intergenerational relationship to you. And a hand-me-down is something that, you know, your older brother or older sister or someone gave to you. And certainly the heirloom has more power. I mean, even the way that they both start with an H,
right.
But an heirloom has power. And I do think that that sense of power comes a little bit about the connection between the generation before you and perhaps a generation before that, and then has a sense of lineage, you know, that is very different than what we would share with a sibling.
Yeah.
And actually I think that all the things that we make, as artists, and even those material cultural objects that we make have that power to become heirlooms.
Right.
If they have resonance in culture in a way. Uh-huh. And so I'm always looking for even the resonance in culture and even simple objects, overlooked objects.
Like what?
Well, for me, it's always in little tiny things and usually the things that end up feeding my studio work. So right now, the thing that I'm most engaged with is fine-toothed black combs, like Ace combs, you know, like
you're kidding, that, really?
Yeah, you know, like the Brill Cream guys and their combs.
Yeah.
And it's in part because I think that combs have this resonance in culture for us anyway. It's in part.
Resonance?
Well,
because you know, one of the things I think immediately when you say that, right? Okay, I think of most people won't use somebody else's comb.
Right.
I don't know why.
They're
very
personal.
But,
things.
You know, if you see one on the street, you never pick it up.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you yuck.
Exactly.
Isn't
that's
it weird?
Exactly
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Because combs have this relationship with how we think about how we primp, how we preen.
Right.
What is organized, civilized behavior. If you were properly coiffed,
you know, and all
of that. But it also comes to, I mean, so combs, as far as I know, they've been with us for about 7,500 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the Persian Valley is where they have the oldest one that they've excavated. And if you think about what they mean, if one grows straight hair, which I don't happen to grow, but if one grows straight hair, then a fine tooth comb means that you would be able to get lice out of your hair and that sort of thing, because lice wouldn't be interested in my type of hair. That's an advantage. But so there is this association between health and grooming, And then that gets into this interesting association between aesthetics and culture. Mm-hmm. As well.
Right.
And so those same Brill Cream guys who were trying to keep their, who had their comb and their Bic pen and their pockets
right.
at the
right.
same time, you right. know, one was about mm-hmm. being ready to write something down and
right.
the other was about being, making sure your hair was in place and
right.
all of that. And so I find that really engaging. And then, of course, many, many, many cultures use combs in lots of different ways. So just simple objects like that, I can find a lot of depth of resonance.
You're also talking about a chair that had been passed down through your family.
Oh.
That I thought was really kind of...
It was a metaphor, cause, actually.
Because I think it speaks to something that we all... Well, go ahead. Yeah.
In that part of the talk that you're referring to, I was referring to... I always try... When I'm talking to people, especially a large crowd of people, I always try and get to a visceral part, something that mm-hmm. We've all experienced mm-hmm. so that it can get, even though I'm speaking about something objectively, that we can all get to it subjectively somehow. And so I come from a lineage of people on my mother's side who were makers. My grandfather was a furniture maker
yeah.
and my grandmother was a tailor, and she would make a very strong distinction between being a seamstress and a tailor.
Yeah.
She could mm-hmm. sew a fine men's suit.
Yes.
And she actually was a moneymaker in the family.
Really?
Well, because if you make a good piece
of
furniture,
no,
then
yeah,
a family
right.
will pass it down from generation
right.
to generation, whereas you need a new wedding dress and you need clothes for church and you need
right.
you know,
yeah.
something for somebody's
yeah.
baptism or whatever. And,
right.
And so clothes, as is true of fashion nowadays, it just, you know, the cycle is faster.
Mm-hmm.
So she actually made the mm-hmm. money in the family, whereas my grandfather made this really fine furniture that, as you mentioned, got passed down. And just this memory of sitting in a chair that my grandfather made. Actually, it's a metaphor of sitting in a chair that my grandfather had made and thinking that my hands as a child was holding that chair, cupping the ends of that chair
yeah.
In the same way that my mother's hands once were.
Right.
The sense that my mother was once had a body that was about child size,
right.
about the size of mine,
right.
and could sit in that same space, and that the chair could hold the memory
right.
of those two people and then also fuse that memory, overlap
mm-hmm.
that memory over
mm-hmm.
time.
Because mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
sense that mm-hmm. objects remember us. You know, they hold our stories.
Yes, interesting. Say more about that. That's really interesting.
Well,
objects are us.
Objects are us.
Toys are us.
Yes,
right.
But objects do remember us. I mean, I think
yeah.
that's what archaeology is all about. You
yeah.
know,
it's yeah.
to try and figure out how objects remember us. How
yeah,
because
you are talking
us.
In an archaeological mm-hmm. sense. You know, yeah. Go ahead.
So the. What I would say that I'm really interested in is a field of material culture. So that's really why we make what we make and what it reflects back to us about our society.
Mm-hmm.
And as an artist, I think that we do that too.
Right.
I think that we make objects that reflect something about society. And as artists, we have to be just a little outside of it.
Right.
But also very
right.
engaged in society.
Exactly.
To be able to see it
yeah.
from a different new perspective that is uniquely through the eyes of that artist, but also to give a vision
that people can resonate
yeah,
to.
That people can understand. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when I was reading it, I was thinking it struck me as talking about that, getting back to the chair, the sort of the very sort of ethereal, almost gossamer thin concept that wafts through our minds every now and again about capturing time somehow, about immortality,
mm.
about how objects can somehow can do this in a way that nothing else can. You
That's
know,
right.
That language
objects
can't.
Usually outlive people. I
yeah,
mean, you know,
right.
a lot of objects
yeah.
outlive people. And that's,
yeah.
in fact, why an heirloom is more resonant or perhaps even more valuable than a hand-me-down.
Right.
A hand-me-down becomes valuable if for, you know, mm-hmm. for some unfortunate reason, if you had a sibling who passed away, then it becomes valuable because it's that memory of that
right.
person in the body. But an heirloom becomes valuable because if it did belong to your great-grandfather
right.
or your great-grandmother or mm-hmm. grandmother or some, that person, and you don't, that person likely
not,
will
yeah.
not outlive you,
right, right.
then you have a piece of that person
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
made immortal in that object.
Yeah, made
of course,
immortal.
A person
yeah.
has met their mortality, but
sure.
their memories that are held in that object.
Well, it's like when somebody's, I mean, this is kind of like Katrina or when somebody's house burns down or something. You know, it almost seems like the things they talk about first are those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. it's not the loss of the house. It's not the loss of the, you know, although the, it could be if the house has been in the family for generations. But whatever that is, you know, whatever that intangible sort of sense of history, sense of belonging and owning and being a part of the past, when that's ripped away from you, you know, when someone says, you know, well, I lost this in a fire and it didn't have any value, but it was the most valuable thing I owned.
Well, you know, I have a friend named Peter Walker, who is from Australia originally and now teaches at RISD, and he's a furniture maker. And since we were talking about furniture and chairs right. and honoring my grandfather, I guess we might as well go this direction. But Peter and I were both I had the privilege of teaching at Haystack Mountain School of Crafts in Maine, and he was teaching a class at the same time. And he had asked his students to bring in something that if their house was burning, something that they would grab and take with them.
Yeah.
And so it has to be something small, because you can't take the house with you. You know, so it has to be something small. It has
hard to
be,
get the desk out.
Right, you know, it's and yet you have time to think about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here he's asking artists to think about what is that object that probably is something portable, because he asked them to bring the object with them up to Maine, you know, as well. It probably is something portable. And it was really an interesting range of things that people brought.
And they all had stories, didn't they?
Of course. And what's interesting about this is that really, you could put a story in anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the beauty of objects, is that almost anything can function as a mnemonic device for us.
Right.
And that's the power that art has, that we can make almost anything into a mnemonic device.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's an interesting way of looking at it. That really is a large... I mean, I don't think I've ever had that thought go through my head in those terms, but... Every artist I think I've ever talked to is talking about that.
Yeah.
Is talking about,
talking about their experience. Or an observation.
Something.
Or even if it's something that happens immediately, the way that you put paint on the canvas right there and something happens and you want it, you keep that one as opposed to the other canvases are gone.
Right.
You know, or when I'm working with materials and I just think, oh, that's a wonderful moment. How do I capture that moment and frame it?
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about hands. Because you talk about that quite a bit, and when you just say, well, hands are important, but then when you start to connect, hands are the things that make objects, and objects are the things that connect us to so much, to our past, to our sense of meaning, to our you know, to just so many things. Okay, so what's the name of the tribe in Peru? Because I'm going to butcher their name.
The Kashinahua.
Oh, yes, that's right. The Kashinahua in Peru. In canoe. Good, Tim. You're getting better at this. I just have a little quote here that just says, you know, that this particular tribe that I can't pronounce the name of believes that the brain as such is not very smart since it doesn't do much. The hands, by contrast, are brilliant.
Well, there's this notion that you can see wisdom and that wisdom is held in the places where... where you see activity. And so, you know, I'm the chair of a craft department. I work in a department where people have very wise hands. Uh-huh. And it's hard to quantify the wisdom of the hands, except that you can see it through the objects that people make.
Yeah.
Really wise hands make things look simple. Uh-huh. Really wise people can explain the most profound thing in the simplest way.
Right.
So... What the Kashinahua are noticing is that, you know, there's a sort of bodily knowledge, this sense that our bodies retain knowledge in a different way. Now, of course, this is what Howard Gardner would call, you know, Howard Gardner from Harvard.
Who wrote, actually, if you don't know, who wrote about the different forms of intelligence. In other words, there's not just IQ as we, you know, there's physical intelligence, there's social intelligence, there's, you know, when you look at an athlete, because that's that particular form of intelligence that most of us will never attain.
But artists have it in a certain way, too.
Yes,
and certainly
yes.
The artists who work very, very adeptly with their hands have that bodily kinesthetic intelligence. And it doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, there's spatial intelligence and all sorts of other kinds of intelligences, too. And so this is a indigenous group in Peru who happened to just frame it in a way that
wonderful.
Yeah, quite poetic.
Yeah. You said it is this notion that I dedicate... My own making, the hands that precede me, those of ancestors known and unknown, wise and knowledgeable hands, the hands that imbued objects with their stories. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I'm very much aware of being an person of African descent, as well as other descents as well, but most evidently a black person here in America, who part of my heritage is people who came here through involuntary migration. The Middle Passage.
Really?
Sounds
when did
about,
that happen?
Yeah, exactly. Middle Passage sounds almost as nice somehow.
Yeah, Middle Passage. Middle
so
Passage kind of is like, you know, where
like
did
the
they come up with that
something.
Word?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Middle Passage. Yeah, yeah. That's almost as good as like historically black universities. That's one of the ones that I've noticed. Like, it's like, well, that's a really interesting way of saying segregated.
Yeah. But so the.
So the Middle Passage.
The Middle Passage, forced migration. So that part of my heritage that came from West Africa, mainly from West Africa, best that I can tell. Here are a group of people who came to the islands. My folks are both from the Caribbean. And they were valued not for what they brought with them.
Right. Because they didn't bring anything. There were no objects.
They couldn't bring anything with them. If they brought anything with them, it was literally what was on their bodies. Mm-hmm. And if that survived the Middle Passage, if they survived the Middle Passage. But what they had brought with them, as a friend of mine says, they came empty-handed but not empty-headed.
Yeah.
And I actually like to say they didn't even come empty-handed, because in their hands came all this
knowledge
of how to work with materials.
Right.
And so
like,
the most highly valued people who could weave, people who knew how to do blacksmithing, people who knew how to do stone carving, people who knew how to farm.
Right.
You know, all of those things that had to do with a manual kind of intelligence made people more valuable. Mm. Now, here I am. Again, chair of a craft department, trying to honor those same traditions, not only in an African-American heritage, but in everybody's heritage in a way, and then also updated in the contemporary times as well. But still honoring that sense of working with one's hands and the intelligence that comes with one's hands. When we see a gymnast do something, we think they make that look really easy. That's amazing. And you think, I would never get on parallel bars to do that. You see a glass blower do something, they can make it look really easy too, until you try and do it yourself. And then you realize, that's a really intelligent body who can do that, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Interesting. Well, talking about your work, as we've sort of been talking more about what sort of drives your thinking process and your interest in all of this, but talking about your work, the Beaded Prayers Project is something that really sort of seems fascinating. Talk about that.
Well, that also started in from a material culture perspective. In my own work, I had been making this work that was dealing with beads, thinking about beads as mnemonic devices. Now, that's not really such a surprise. Beads on abacuses, you know, a way of calculating things. In some places that speak Spanish, the word cuentas means like an account, but it also means a story, you know, and it also means beads, those things together. So accounting and beads and story.
You're getting back to objects again that have a history.
That's right.
That
the material culture, right? Yeah, so this notion of what is a story that's in the object in a sort of anthropological kind of way.
Right.
And I also became interested in the fact that bead and prayer in our language that we're speaking to each other in English, have the shared etymology, that the words both mean prayer, and that comes from beads using beads as mnemonic devices.
Right.
Rosary beads.
Right.
Right.
Or Buddhist.
And so,
you know.
Yes, but in English, it's rosary beads.
Right. Yes.
I mean, there are lots of traditions that use them, but the word bead comes from the word from the verb bidan, which means to ask or to pray, and the word is spelled BIDDAN. And we get bid from, like, I bid you well, which is a little antiquated. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you can see bid and bead would be related. And so the project really came from that notion of, isn't that amazing that these little beads that I'm using actually fused in some time ago as bead and prayer being the same thing, the object and its function as a mnemonic device.
Right.
So what I did with this project is I wanted to open my studio up to the wider community. As as you know, art making can be a very lonely pursuit. Sure. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it needs to be a solitary pursuit, and that's great. But I'm sort of a social creature. So this project allowed me to take the idea of how beads are used as mnemonic devices out into the world and ask people to write down their own wishes, hopes, dreams, or prayers if they're religious people. Though there are plenty of atheists represented in the crowd.
Plenty of atheist beads out there.
And to write them down and to make these packets that were then beaded shut or stitched shut with beads. And right now, the project officially started in 1998. The first exhibition of it was in Australia, a very small exhibition, in 1999. I think we maybe had about 200 of them at that point. Mm-hmm. And for 5 years, between 1999 and 2004, I was giving workshops all over the world and had a website that was launched so that people could make them themselves and mail them in. Mm-hmm. And I asked people to make two, though there's no way of proving whether people did that or not. One to keep for themselves and one to contribute to the project. And in 2004, I had to shut down the mail-in version of the project because the project pretty much doubled overnight.
Really?
Yes, it got
quite big.
Why
do you think that was?
I think the word just gets out, and I was more concerned of whether I was going to be able to shut it down as easily as I could.
Well, let me sort of play devil's advocate, because what I want to, and I don't know if we can get at this right now, but what were you trying to do here? What was...
I was trying to make art into an activity that was democratized. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it.
Right.
I think.
But
that's...
why have them write down something?
Oh, why was I having them write down a prayer?
Yes.
Because of the relationship in bead and prayer, the name of the project.
Okay.
The project was titled Beaded Prayers.
All right.
Because of the relationship of the word bead and prayer.
Okay.
And then what I did leave out in my description of it is that I was also looking at these amulets that I kept seeing all over the world, but my first connection to them was in my research in West Africa, that usually contained either powerful medicinal stuffs.
Right.
Or written prayers, often from the Quran.
And so it seems like, I mean, what I'm getting at here is there almost seems to be a, what's the word? I mean, this thing took off.
It did.
You didn't have to do a lot of, this wasn't like, you know, you turn on television and say, join our bead thing. You know, something.
Well, it didn't take off so easily, Tim. I mean,
But obviously it resonates. That's what I'm saying. This resonates. Huh. We're talking about beads. We're talking about writing down something. We're talking about putting in a pouch. We're talking about sewing it shut. Somehow there's something in this process that really resonates with people. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I think that people get it. I think that the idea of a locket, which would probably be the closest that we have sort of in kind of Western thinking here, to take something that's really precious to you, enclose it in something else, and then wear it on your body, which is how the amulets are worn.
Right.
Or mezuzahs, which aren't worn on someone's
Jewish
body, but they're
on the door frame.
But they're worn collectively.
Correct.
By the architecture, you know? Everybody who's in a household would, or in a room, would be wearing that amulet or protected by it. And that's the thing. I found these kinds of amulets all over the world. So it is a sort of human endeavor. And I am interested in those places where we meet at a very basic level and are connected, and then all the diversity that happens around that. Like these traditions are not the same, but they are all connected.
Connected.
So the project grew and it's still traveling.
Have you gotten involved with Jung at all or the collective subconscious?
My first degree is in psychology.
Is it? Yeah, because it almost speaks a little bit to that.
Yeah.
A little bit to that sort of, you know, collective
unconscious.
But this runs through all cultures and surfaces in different ways in different cultures, just as religion seems to surface in different also with many of the same themes.
Right.
Which, you know, and these people didn't have televisions or telephones to be talking to each other, you know, but like here's this, you know, Adam and Eve, the whole concept seems to, you know, emerge in a lot of different kinds of religions.
Well, I mean, I think that same sense of if something is precious to you, we were talking about this earlier with Peter Walker, but if something's precious to you, then you would want to attach it to your body. You would want to keep it as close to you as possible. And if that's the thing that's protecting you, reminding you of who you are, you know, your identity and a culture and all of that. I mean, we do it nowadays too, but usually
well,
with
do,
branding
know,
and labels and that sort of thing.
That, well,
but not even, I'm talking about pure marketing, you know, that I had a student say to me the other day, I didn't think you would have a bag made by that, you know, brand. And I said, why? And she said, well, that's kind of a cyclist kind of cool brand. And I was like, okay, careful. I haven't graded you this semester. But, you know, the brand didn't fit with who I was.
Right.
The brand spoke so loudly. But we do that, you know. Nike is a god. Yes. And I mean, you know, like this is...
Well,
this
it's
is
an interesting concept you say that because, you know, yeah, Nike just do it. I mean, they're not... They don't get on television and talk about how great their sneakers are.
No.
They completely bypass that and they reach into your into you subjectively, which is where we started this conversation. And they reach into you subjectively and one person goes, well, I can buy a pair of sneakers and walk around the block and that'll work. Or I can buy a pair of sneakers and go run 10 miles and that'll work. I mean, it's amazing way something just simple like that, like just do it, can speak on so many different levels to so many different people.
Well, advertisers are really good at getting into the psyche of human beings. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't make any money.
That's right. That's true.
Otherwise, they wouldn't make any money. Anyway, so back to the Beat of Praise Project. It. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I was going to tell you to turn off your cell phone, by the way. It should be good. Record this.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm just writing down when to bleep that out of there.
I don't think I was speaking, but any case. So, the Beaded Prayers Project, we stopped accepting, and I say we because it's a collective project,
right.
But really, I mean me. I stopped accepting the mailed in ones, and on January 1st of 2004, and now the project is still traveling. It's been to about 24 different venues at this point, museums and cultural centers and all over the place. And there have been, to date, about 5,000 people who have participated in it from 35 different nations. So it really is quite a wonderful thing for me to be involved in because of all that I learned from the people. I know the project really well.
Right.
We've known each other since 1998. It's going on 10 years.
Right.
But as I talk about the project with people and in the venues that it's shown, I still allow people at those venues to add to the project at workshops just so that it doesn't double, but the enrollment management. To see the project through their eyes and to hear, have them say, this reminds me of this. Oh, did you know that in Indonesia we do this? And it makes me smarter. It makes the project smarter. And so it really is about that collective wisdom. Which I count on. I actually do think that, though there are many theories that negate this notion, but I actually do think that many minds together can accomplish something more than one mind.
Yeah.
So I believe in collective
wisdom.
Well,
it's a wonderful way to end. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And it's always, you know, I keep telling people you have to write it and tell us we have to do the show for an hour. But it just never is enough time. But thank you, Sonia, very much for talking about your work and your interests, and because it is fascinating. And thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you again for lunch on the radio next Friday at 12:30. And once again, this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.